Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys Podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Sabrina, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was introduced to you by a mutual friend, Hannah Kay, who's been on the show before. And she's someone, whenever I'm talking about the troubled teen industry, I'm like, whoever you say to talk to, wherever you think I should point this, I'll take your word for it. And I'm so glad we connected, because just from the brief email you sent me, there's so many crossover points between my show and kind of your experiences. Take me back to the very beginning. Like, take me back to childhood Sabrina, pre-troubled teen industry, and kind of paint a picture of what your life looked like during that time.
So I was given up for adoption at birth by my biological mother. She was addicted to drugs, and she put me up for adoption. And I was adopted 3 months later. And my adoptive mother had already had three previous adoptive children. They were all biologically related, but they were all adopted. And she pretty much abused all four of us. And throughout the years, she just slowly started sending us off one by one as we got old enough, around 10, 11 years old, to start telling people, hey, we're getting abused, telling teachers at school. I remember my brothers being 9 and 10 years old, and she would kick them out the house and then report them as runaways. And my brother Chris actually got sent to one of what I think is the worst schools in America in this industry, which was Dozer School for Boys in Marianna, Florida. I don't know if you've heard of that program, but it's awful. They found over 100 bodies on the property.
Wow.
Yeah. And so he went to that school from 94 to 96. And then she sent my brother, Joey, and then she sent my sister at 15. And then I got sent away at 11. And so that's pretty much how it went down. And I was separated from my siblings. My brother, Joey, the last time I saw him in person, I was 7 years old. My brother, Chris, he just found me in March of this year. He found me on TikTok.
Wow.
He had just got out of prison, and I happened to have been in Florida at the time for my grandma's funeral. And he reached out, see me on TikTok, and was like, hey, I'm out of prison. I know you don't really know me, you know, that much, because the last time you saw me, you were a little girl. And something told me, like, go talk to him, you know. And I'm so glad I did, because then I found out that it wasn't just juvie in prison. He had been thrown in the same industry I had been. Mm. It was pretty much adoption to prison pipeline. So,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much to follow through that story, but it's certainly one that's been echoed many times from so many survivors of the troubled teen industry, is that the homes they were coming from were abusive often. And then, like you said, you get to an age where you can start confronting that or knowing something's wrong, and you get discarded into this industry, and the parenting becomes outsourced. You mentioned it was 11 when you were sent to your first...
I was 11.
Okay. And was there a specific reason for you that was given as to why they're sending you away, or was it just...
Well, according to my cousin Joe, who encouraged his mother, which is my aunt Sherry, to send me away, it was because I was annoying. I was ADHD, had dyslexia, you know, and I was annoying. And I wasn't a bad kid. I didn't run away from home, wasn't into drugs, wasn't, you know, doing all kinds of crazy stuff. When I was 9 years old, my adopted mother had gotten cancer, and she fell very ill. Mm. She had diabetes. She had had a stroke, heart failure, all kinds of stuff going on with her. She was on dialysis for kidney failure. And so I went to go live with a family friend named Connie, which was my adopted mother's friend. She also had adoptive children, and one of the older children was molesting me. And when Connie had found out, she had told my adoptive mother. They came and picked me up. Nothing became of it. I started wetting the bed at 11 years old. And she caught me in the middle of the night changing my sheets from wetting the bed. And she made me sleep in the urine-soaked sheets. And I went to school smelling like urine. And I went to school, you know, obviously stinking. And, you know, they were questioning, asking what was going on. And then there was an investigation. CPS came out. Next thing I knew, the next day I was living with my aunt. So I figured, okay, they took me out the home to go live with my aunt because this isn't what's going on. But Mary was really manipulative. She had a brother that was a cop. She was really good at spinning what every story she could to manipulate the situation. And I lived with my Aunt Sherrod for a couple months. Prior to me living with Aunt Sherrod, my sister had lived with her. And then she had sent my sister off. And then I came home from school one day. I went to an independent fundamental Baptist ACE school tomorrow school. At a Bible Baptist church in St. Augustine, Florida. And I came home from school and she's like, you're going to go to a boarding school. And I was like, oh, Hogwarts, like, you know, cool.
Right.
And it was nothing like Hogwarts. And she had told me, you're going to be with your sister. So I went willingly under the impression of, oh my gosh, I'm going to be with my sister. When right. I arrived at Charity Haven in Milton, Florida, 11 years old, sister's nowhere to be found. So obviously I did a major flip out, you know, scared, you lied, you tricked me, all these crazy rules, like you're not allowed to look at each other, you're not allowed to talk without permission, you had to drink Epsom salt and water, like crazy stuff, and reciting these, you know, Bible verses. Now, mind you, I loved Sunday school. I was raised Baptist and that was something that I actually enjoyed, but until religion was used as a weapon against me, you know, then things took a different turn and there was no plan of what's wrong. Why are you here? What could have caused you to be here? What was going on in your home? There was no kind of like individualized specific plan to meet my needs in the program. It was a one size fits all kind of like program. Right. And you either fall in line or they're going to beat the crap out of you. And right. that's pretty much what happened to me. And I spent 2.5 months of the 3 months I was at Charity Haven in an isolation room called the prayer room.
In retrospect, like now as an adult looking back, what do you think 11-year-old Sabrina did need during that time period? Because obviously you went through a lot of trauma very young. You're going from house to house. You're dealing with, you know, abuse. You're dealing with, you know, siblings being present and suddenly not being present. What do you wish you would have gotten at that age in place of what you did receive?
Well, for starters, I wound up taking an ancestry DNA test later on in life and finding both sets of my biological family. And I was pretty pissed off when I found out that I was wanted. So kinship adoption should have been the first step instead of letting some stranger who thought she was owed a child, children she did not want to raise, you know. And so that's what I needed. I needed my biological mother to not lie to my dad and tell her that I had died from heart complications and that she buried me out in Georgia somewhere. So that would have been the first step, you know. And the second step was for the people in my life, the adults, the teachers, the family members, the aunts, the uncles that stood by and did nothing and just kind of looked the other way when they knew abuse was going on. I needed them to speak up. These kids are being mistreated. These kids are being hurt. This is what I'm seeing. I needed CPS to do their jobs. I needed someone to give me counseling. I had been molested, sexually abused, physically abused. I mean, my adoptive mother shaved my head when I was 4 years old because I cut a piece of hair of my own hair because I wanted to be like my doll, Dolly Surprise, whose hair would get short and long when you raised its arm. You know, a normal parent would be like, oh, sweetie, don't cut your hair, or oh, your hair's not going to grow back, you know, for a while. We'll put a little pretty bow in it. No, she just shaved my head like G.I. Jane. You know, I needed a loving home. I needed understanding parents. I needed parents who weren't racist. She was extremely racist. She would threaten to trade me for a white child all the time. And I was like, please do. By the time I was 11, you kind of just start running your mouth back and you just kind of get used to it. And so if anything, I was guilty of running my mouth back to her and getting to the point where you're not going to hit me no more. You're not going to abuse me. And that was just kind of like a, now we're just going to ship her off. I needed my ADHD to be acknowledged because in the independent fundamental Baptist world, they just beat the ADHD out of you. There's no such thing as dyslexia. There's no such thing as autism or neurodivergent or anything. And I needed something. Well, they didn't have that back then, but like Brain Balance or Sylvan Learning Center, a tutor to help me with my education. All the things that I needed was not what I got. I could have stayed home. I could have got counseling and those kind of things, but nobody thought of that.
The system on every level really failed you as a kid. And then you're slapped with a label of troubled and sent to one of these homes. I know for many listening, they already know about the process of many of these homes, but I want to set the picture of what you needed versus what you got. And you mentioned being in isolation. You're not allowed to talk to other kids. Like your core relationships are taken away. You went to several different homes. Was your experience pretty uniform across the board in each one? Was it a scale of bearable to
extreme? There was some. So obviously when I went to Charity Haven, I thought it was like the worst thing of the world. Right. I could have faked it till I made it. Had I known that there was worse programs out there, I just would have faked it till I made it and just would have went along with it. But at 11, you don't think that way, you know? And I want to say the worst programs I was in was Bethel Boys and Girls Academy and the Rebecca Home for Girls. Those were the worst two programs. I went to Reclamation Ranch, which is owned by Jack Patterson, a Lester Roloff protege. And that was probably like the most bearable out of them all, but abusive stuff still happened. It was the same. Right. I like to say same shit, different toilet.
That's a good way to put it. So you were in this from 11 to the time you were 18.
6 years, 9 months.
So that's some of your most formative time. It's developing you.
I came out with like zero social skills, super weird and awkward.
Right. Because again, you're going in from a very toxic environment into a system that's purports to help you, but puts you through the ringer and leaves you definitely with far more trauma and confusion. Tell me about Sabrina exiting that program.
So imagine what it would be like for a child to experience violence every day for 18 years straight. Good thing for masking. I was a pro at that. Because I knew in my home and from in the programs that even though this is what goes on when you go to church, it's a whole nother face that you put on. You act like nothing is going on. So that's what I did I pretty much dissociated from the time I got off the program till about 2011, 2013. I pretty much like put it all in the back of my head like it didn't even happen until 2013. I saw Bill McNamara from New Beginnings Girls Academy in the town I was living in at the time. And then Jack Patterson tried to open up a program. And then I was like, nope. And I pretty much started talking about it. I started having PTSD nightmares pretty early on. I wouldn't remember exactly what they were, but at the time, my husband, now then boyfriend, would be like, hey, you were like telling me get off you and all this kind of stuff. And what was that all about? So he was the first person I essentially broke down and told him what had happened. He has a similar kind of childhood, not with the programs, but, you know, had an abusive stepfather. So he understood. And so from then on, I just kind of started telling him more and more and more. And it was kind of like slowly at a time because they had conditioned us that no one's going to believe you. And I honestly believed that until social media became a thing, and I started Facebooking and started meeting, or not meeting, but finding people I went to programs with. And then they were like, we would message each other like, hey, you remember this? And they'd be like, yeah, that was crazy. And you're like, okay, I'm not crazy. That happened. You know?
So how much of that was, you knew it was crazy? Cause this is the part that's why I mentioned like going in at such a young age and then leaving. You know, people throw around the term institutionalized, but really you are. And there's so many things that are normalized during that time. Like, what percentage of your experience did you actually recognize was abusive? And then how much of it was, oh, now that someone's telling it back to me, or I'm sharing it, now I realize.
I knew I was abused. I knew. I knew from the time I was 12 years old, I was going to write a book about my life. I knew it. I was abused. I tried to tell family, other family members, like my adoptive aunt, cousins, and they would constantly, back then I didn't know it was called gaslighting, but that's essentially what they were doing, was like, that didn't happen. Or if you had done this, this wouldn't have happened. And then now as a parent and motherhood, there's a saying that says motherhood unlocks all your childhood wounds. And boy, ain't that the truth. I have two kids. My daughter is at the age I was when I left the programs, and my son is at the age where I went into the programs. So it's been a roller coaster. And as I'm navigating parenting and then figuring out, like, because my son's also dyslexic and ADHD and was having some similar issues with school and falling behind in math, some of the same issues I had. And I'm like, okay, you're funny, God. Okay. Let's figure out what he needs, because I'm going to be the example of, you can get your kid help without sending them away. And when going through the whole parenting journey, I was like, man, I would never do this to my kids. I would never waterboard my children. I would never make them sleep in my bathtub and spray them in the cold face with cold water. I would never waterboard them on the kitchen table with a 2-liter bottle of ginger ale. And I started thinking about these things that they used as punishments. And I'm like, the punishment didn't work because it didn't teach a lesson. It was out of vain. It was out of cruelty. And so I knew. And then just becoming a mother kind of just drove it home for me of, this was wrong. This was messed up. But it was hard for me to talk about it with other people for a long time.
It is fascinating being a parent. And then also, like, even beyond being a parent, I've been saying a lot recently, like, now I'm getting to the age of like leadership that you're under when you're a kid, like, mm-hmm. you're the age of the teachers you had, or the age of the coaches you had, and the age that your parents were, you know, at certain points. And it's so interesting. Like you said, you're like, man, I knew people that sent their kids that are my kids' age away to these facilities, or I know parents that did this. And you look at your kid in the eyes and go like, I could never do that. Like, sure, there's times I feel lost and go like, what do I do? But then you go into problem solving, not just like, let's remove myself from this equation. So you mentioned like the programming of like not thinking people would believe you, but then you have luckily significant other that is believing you. You're finding other people in the community very early on, 2013, before this is like everywhere. How quick was the process of like sharing a little bit to like, okay, the dam's burst, I'm sharing a lot? And through that process, like, how re-traumatizing was it to be sharing it? Like, cause you can't really prepare for that.
It was extreme. 2020, when Broken Code Silence came out as a thing, my friend Alan Ohl, who went to Bethel with me, did a podcast on your show, and I was forcing my husband and his friend to watch it, you know, and my husband's sitting there like, how could people not hear all these stories? This kid was there at the same time as you, and you're telling the same similar, I mean, our situations were different, but we had similar experiences in the program. And then even with people who had been in the program decades before or after, how could you think that we're all liars? And I think from that moment on, I was just like, I'm telling it. And if you don't believe me, it is what it is. Cause I'm not trying here to convince you. I'm trying to say, you know, save kids from going to these places from parents being naive and believing that these places are going to save their kids. Not everyone's going to believe me, and that's fine. You know, I'm not here for likes and views and to be the next Paris Hilton. I'm Sabrina Young and I stand on business and there's kids dying, you know? And for me, I think it really pissed me off when I found out how huge the industry was, which I knew there was a lot of Christian programs, but I didn't know it was anything like this. So 2020, I kind of had a little mental breakdown there for a little bit. I was an essential
Understandably
employee.
So. Yeah.
I was an essential employee. So I was working 73 hours a week during the pandemic for a year and a half straight. Oh. Tired, going through all this stuff. So in the meantime, the downtime I had, I was like, okay, I'm going to write a book. I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to do it. I found my family. I can do this. So I started writing about pretty much, you know, the adoption abuse and finding my bio family. And then I was like, okay, I think I feel confident, strong enough that I can talk about this and talk about what I went through with the programs and then finally just kind of talk about it. It took me about, I don't know, from around 2017 to 2020 to fully, by 2021, I was telling it all, like everything that was going on, naming names. I'm the type, I will tag my abusers in my posts. I don't care. I'm that bitch. Yeah. Sorry if I cuss. I'm from the south side of the kingdom. Okay. I love Jesus, but I cuss a little.
This might be a bit of a detour, but I'm fascinated by the effects that these experiences have on different people. And because there is, I mean, I know, you know, there's so many different personalities and types of people that come out of these programs. Yeah. And I'm blown away by your confidence. You're, you know, like you said, you're willing to say what needs to be said. And it was clearly identifiable to you. Like, this is wrong. Like, I'm sure you've encountered people who come out of these programs and go, it helped me. Or, hey, if you followed the rules, like, or even some like, oh, I knew so-and-so and no wonder they had a bad experience because they were always in trouble or whatever. Like, why do you think, because like, again, you hear these conditions, like you gave a couple examples, like, I mean, people heard Alan's episode, like the torture that people went through. Why do you think some people come out of those experiences and say it was a positive impact on them? Because there's nothing positive in the story. Like, they'll even tell you what they experienced and you're like,
because it's conditional brainwashing. We really were conditioned to believe that this was what was best for us to help us. I mean, I would tell people out in the community, hey, this is what happened at Jack Patterson's ranch. And they would go, well, if you weren't such a troubled kid, maybe they would have treated you better. And then I'm like, sounds like you're saying that I deserved being abused, troubled or not. No, I wasn't troubled, because nowhere did you ask about my family dynamics, why I went to the program. As soon as they would hear she was in a program, it's automatic, oh, troubled kid. The programs were never designed to figure out what you needed. They were never designed that way. And so I think for the longest time, and for a little bit, I did too, very at the end, I thought, because the last program I was in was the least abusive, that it was the best program. It saved my life and everybody loved me. And then I was like, no, by the time I left that program, was out for a little bit and got sent back. By the time I left that program, I was like, yeah, no, this program didn't save my life. It's full of shit. I mailed letters out from other girls, snuck them out my suitcase and mailed them out. And I just, at that point, I didn't care. So in the state of Alabama, you're not an adult till you're 19. And I had no way of looking this information up. They're not going to tell you the truth, you know? And so they had said, you're going to stay here till you're 19 and be junior staff. And I said, no, I'm not. And they're like, yeah, you are. And I said, okay, well, the next time we go on tour and we go to a revival and I give my scripted testimony, guess which version I'm going to give them. And so essentially I pretty much bullied my way to leave the program. And I think they knew, like, oh, she'll run her mouth. And I really wish I had still ran my mouth and left, but I was still so scared. I kept my end of the bargain, but I mailed out letters too, you know, so I'll shut my mouth, you shut yours.
Right. So. And there's plenty of time to run your mouth later. So, yeah. You know, and share what,
and I
share
did.
What really happened.
Yeah.
Right. I was curious about that because, like I said, it's interesting hearing those two perspectives looking back at the same situation. And
I think if you also already come from a religious background, that just adds another layer onto the brainwash. I have literally gone back and forth on what I believe in religion. One out of fear base, you know, I remember being locked in an isolation room thinking the rapture happened because a siren was going off, you know, where they would test the sirens. I didn't know that was a thing. And so the town was testing the sirens and I thought, oh my God, no one's came and checked on me. The rapture happened. I'm going to, you know, get my head chopped off by the guillotine, you know, crazy stuff. And I literally thought that I was going to die and go to hell at 11. But then, you know, they would say stuff like, oh, well, children, when they die, they go to heaven. So I'm like, well, why do you need to save my soul if I were to die anyways and I'm innocent? And then they would say, well, you're an abomination because your parents mixed races. My mom's black, my dad's white. So then I was like, well, then why are you trying to save my soul if I'm going to hell and I'm damned anyways for being an abomination? So it was a catch-22. So I was screwed up for years afterwards. Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's back to school season, and it's a great reminder for everybody how important education and personal development truly is. And therapy has been an amazing tool for me to improve my outlook on life and my day-to-day experiences. I started using BetterHelp a couple of months ago, and honestly, when I started using it, I was skeptical as to whether or not therapy would be helpful for me specifically. And the way life has worked out has been an amazing case study in how valuable therapy can be. Shortly after signing up, I experienced some major life transitions, including major shifts with my career, adjustments to my living situation, and even the passing of a family member. And my therapist was there to walk through all of those things with me. I don't like promoting services or products that I don't use for myself, and I can honestly say that meeting with my therapist every single week has become an absolute highlight of my month for me. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to anybody's schedule, including an insanely busy podcaster. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Rediscover your curiosity with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/preacherboys today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/preacherboys. All right, let's get back to the show. You mentioned the religious side, like, and you mentioned you're still religious on some level. Yeah. What has that been like working through that? Because obviously dealing with the here and now is one thing, but then the existential crises that traumatic religious upbringing can bring is a lot to work through. I know I'm certainly still working through a lot of that. Was it something that you were, was it like all of this is intersecting and I'm dealing with it as it comes up? Or was it like, I'm going to put religion on the back burner and deal with this? Like, how did that kind of structurally?
When I got out the programs, I was essentially homeless. And a family from a church that I had connections with in Ohio let me live with them. And they were like, you have to go to church Sunday, you know, twice a day. You have to go on Wednesdays, to the point where I even had to make sure my job went, you know, the work schedule was coinciding with church. And when I found out I was pregnant, unmarried, I got kicked out, homeless again. And, you know, I kind of like didn't really go to church because nobody was forcing me. But at the time, my boyfriend's mom would sometimes go to church and she was like, they need a Sunday school teacher. Are you interested? You're good with kids. You work in a daycare. But I had so much shame from being pregnant and not married. I'm like, I should not be a Sunday school teacher. What are you talking about? Like, it's so, it was so confusing from how other churches are versus how I was taught. Independent Fundamental Baptist is like the 1950s. the way that they do things is so different. Like, women are to be silent in the church. Women are not to have pastoral, you know, jobs or to be a deacon or anything. Like, you could be a Sunday school teacher or, you know, have your little, what's it called? Secret sisters meetings that you have where you swap gifts, right. You know, be a youth leader, ladies, but that's tea. Yeah. Ladies tea brunching, but none of that. And I was just like, why would you want me to be a Sunday school teacher? Like, I just had so much shame. So there for a while, I would only go to church if like a family member invited me for whatever reason. And I had a big foster family situation. So let me explain. When I went to Reclamation Ranch, I was 15 years old. I got kicked out of the Rebecca Home for Girls. And I went to Jack Patterson's ranch, and he would take us on tour, which is where we would travel in a bus, go to churches and kind of promote the program. Well, we ended up in a church called Gateway Baptist Church in Eaton, Ohio. Have you know, I live right beside that church. I bought my house. It's right beside it. Anyways, I go to this church. I'm giving my testimony, and this family is like, well, she's not troubled. Why is she here? And they were like, we'd like her to come live with us. We have a biracial daughter, and they get along because I had met the daughter. She had developmental disabilities. We wrote letters, and they're like, we want her to come live with us. So Miss Trudy from the ranch was like, you know what? They want you to come live with them. I talked to your aunt. She says it's fine. Do you want to go live with them? I don't believe you belong here. And so that was another reason I thought that this was the best program, because no program would have ever done that. Like, let some strangers from a church come get this kid who just needs a loving home, right? So I thought I was going to get a normal life, and it wasn't normal. I was treated just like, I don't even know how to explain it. It was automatic defense because I'd been in the program. They pretty much just assumed I was going to do stuff or be promiscuous. And so then it was like, oh, you think I'm going to be this way? Let me show you how bad I can be. I got in an argument because I had a magazine with Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, Madonna 2000s awards. They were kissing, and I had a picture of it cut out in like a scrapbook of all the, all the pop culture events I had missed out in the program. It was all in the scrapbook, and I had it underneath my bed, and that's just where I'd kept it. And I was sitting on the floor taping my pictures in. And I remember Holly coming in saying, it's time for church. And I closed it, shoved it underneath my bed. Well, I guess I must've done it sneakily, I guess, or assumed sneakily, which I was just shoving it underneath my bed. She looked at it and was so upset over these pictures of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera that it caused an argument. And so instead of walking out the front door to like calm down, because I didn't want a situation to escalate, I snuck out the bedroom window, walked to my boyfriend's house to like go vent, and I wound up getting sent back to the program because I left the window open. And her daughter had had surgery. She had a brain hemispherectomy where they take the part of the brain that's causing epilepsy out. And because I left that window open, she's like, she could have got sick. She could have got pneumonia. But at that time, that's not what I was thinking. And I left it open just enough so that I could sneak back in and get back inside. So I went going back to the ranch, and It was different this time. We had more girls, and pretty much what Jack Patterson did was he really wasn't there that much. He had other people run the programs for him while he street preached and stuff. But these people that ran the programs obviously were not qualified. But when I would sit there and tell them all the horrific shit that the other programs did, they would take those tactics and then apply them. So then the program just kind of got worse and worse and worse. And by that point, I was like, fuck this. I'm done. I want out of here. I'm not conforming. I will beat everybody up. It got to the point where girls were scared of me. And that's not something I'm proud of. I've had to go back and apologize to these women for beating the shit out of them. But they also trained us that way to attack one another. For a long time, I dealt everything conflict with conflict. I did not know how to de-escalate a situation during a conversation, when to walk away. I just knew how to solve violence with violence. And I hated that part of myself. And I guess when I became a mother, and that's how I was resolving my conflicts with my children, not really with violence, but by yelling or raising my voice when I got frustrated because I didn't know how to talk calmly. And it got to the point where my daughter was 14 and she's like, "Mom, you need help. Like, all we're doing is yelling." And I was like, "You know what? She's right." And I tell her all the time, like, "You saved my life, kid, again," you know? And so I wound up going to therapy and kind of like figuring out 3 years of therapy to like figure out. And I'm still trying to figure it out, trying to learn social skills I didn't have because I have all these gaps that were missing and not filled in from being in the program. I mean, think what that does to a child's brain and their development, and they're missing all these key elements. And then you expect them at 18 to be a full functioning adult, and they're not. I mean, I didn't know how to get my driver's license, file taxes, bank account, carry on a conversation with someone, understand tone, body responses, body posture, you know, facial expressions. I just didn't know how to really engage or interact. And it really kind of messed me up to the point where I didn't want to be around people for the longest time because I couldn't relate.
And that's the issue with like the corporal punishment. And punishment, like I said, it's a very fancy word for torture in these programs. Like, you're learning how to communicate from people that don't know how to communicate well enough to teach you. So it's like this cycle, and it's the reason you do see so many that leave programs and struggle with that stuff, or even get into trouble with law enforcement. Like, you know, and there's a whole field of issues there that, you know, and the way that those situations are handled. For just really quickly, I'm curious, like, all these programs, how were they paid for? Was it all through?
So they were all tuition based.
Okay.
But I believe that they were getting subsidy from the government for me because I was adopted. So when my adopted mother passed away, my aunt was not only collecting subsidies as a foster parent, but she was also collecting death social security benefits, and that those were being sent in every now and then. And staff have physically told me, like, "Hey, your parents do not pay your tuition." So that was a large part of the reason why I kept getting kicked out of these programs, because they were like, "We're not putting up with this little hellion, and we're not even getting paid for it," you know, because they would send checks here and there. We had kind of like a commissary account. So if you needed shampoo, body wash, toiletries, you had to have money on this account. And I never had money on the account for anything. I either was given stuff via charity or from other girls, or, you know, whatever was left from the bottom of the barrel. My family's never sent me letters, care packages. I got one care package from another aunt at the Rebecca home. They sent a Tommy Hilfiger black skirt that went to my knees. I was allowed to look at it and not keep it because it didn't go to my ankles. I couldn't have nail polish, and the things that she sent me, you couldn't even have. So how are you sending these things to me, not even knowing whether I'm allowed to have it or not? It clearly shows you don't know what kind of program I'm in. So not cheap. Miss Trudy at the ranch actually is the only staff that ever, the only time I ever got birthday, Christmas, anything, she paid for all of that. I was completely like, I believe it was a grooming situation. She treated me like as if her child. She wanted to adopt me, and my aunt would not allow her to, for whatever reason it was. And probably because they were claiming me on their taxes and didn't want to give up that little check they were getting. And so that's when Miss Trudy was like, "Well, they're not going to let me adopt her. I'll let someone else, like, let her live with someone else, because she doesn't need to be." The programs were making me a mean, angry person. Like, I went in 11 years old, remember watching girls get beat up, and I was like, "I'm not going to be like them." And by the time I left the program, I was hitting girls in the face. Like, I hit a pregnant girl in the face. I didn't care. You know, I was an evil, mean person.
Yeah. I apologize if this is out of order, but I'm okay. There's so many different things.
I know, it's so complex.
and I do think, like, I've done many of these interviews. I was telling beforehand, like, I feel like sometimes you go so chronologically through these stories, you miss the themes that are right there. And so, you know, I hope, hopefully for people listening, at least for myself, this is very helpful in kind of understanding some of this. I hope for people listening as well. You mentioned like the staff there, and I get it's similar to when I hear about youth pastors and pastors that get in these complicated webs of just horrible situations where it's like, are they intentionally covering the, like, are, and I think as human beings, we go like, they can't be this bad. Right. And we start trying to run defense in our mind for it. Do you think looking back, and I'm sure you've encountered former staff since leaving.
Oh, I still talk to some of the former staff because I'm petty and curious by nature. And I always wanted to be a journalist. It's what I wanted. I was like the Nancy Drew of the 90s and, you know, kid, all into the, what's the Hardy Boys books. And, you know, that's what I wanted to do. And so then when I came to this realization of, hey, I really was abused, I'm not crazy, this happened. Now it was like, I'm going to prove it, because I had a cousin who said I was crazy. I made this all up. He's like, I begged my mom to send you away at 11. I said, oh, thanks for saying that on a recorded phone call that you essentially just admitted to having me trafficked. You know, he was mad I was writing a book and tried to threaten to sue me. And, you know, took care of that one. But I was just like, okay, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. Cause when people ask me, oh my God, you went through all this stuff. How did you survive? You're so resilient. Spite. What I went through did not make me a strong person. I shouldn't have had to go through that to be a strong person. It didn't make me strong. It made me weak, gave me self-esteem issues. I wanted to die. I felt worthless. I was to the point where I was wishing like, my mom should have gave me, instead of giving me up for adoption, she should have had an abortion, you know? And so for me, I just was like, okay, spite. I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to get my lick back, but I'm going to do it the right way. And I'm going to prove to you guys all that I'm not crazy. So in an attempt to prove that I'm not crazy, I just started looking back through stuff I was finding online, through news articles, the history, you know, I found out all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, Roloff was selling children, having children sold from Podesta. He was having the pregnant girls come in to Podesta home, and he was selling their babies for $250 at the Piggly Wiggly. When you tell people these things, they're like, oh, you're crazy. You're like, nope, here's the link, you know? And it's sad that you have to like show somebody to get them to believe you nowadays. And it's just frustrating, because when it comes to children, I feel like it gets overlooked because of the Christianity that's involved in these places. It's like, they possibly couldn't have done that. They're a good person. They go to church. Just because someone goes to church and they're a Christian doesn't mean that they're a good person.
Would you say the majority of the staff that you dealt with were legitimately, because there are stories, obviously, especially stories like Bethel Boys Academy, like sadistic, and they liked being able to hurt people. Do you think there was a large percentage that were extremely naive, underpaid, well-intentioned?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Like, what do you think the like split between those is in your experience?
When it comes to the owners definitely knew. They were proteges from Roloff, trained by Roloff, worked on the farm. The people underneath that, I feel like the ones that they got from other churches, like, hey, yeah, we need someone to help us with their girls' home, our Bible college. Yes, because, you know, Church of Scientology does the same thing. They recruit people from the church. It's naive. It's same shit, different toilet. Like I said, I've researched this. Almost every religion, every has their hands in this industry and in programs. And I feel like a lot of them were naive. There was some that left right after a few months. I remember our dorm mother, Miss Missy, she was in her 20s, a college, you know, college age. She would take us to contemporary Christian concerts, which, you know, is a no-no in the IFB world. And she would take us to beaches, and we got to do things that the boys didn't get to. And then all of a sudden we didn't get to do those things, but it was like marketing and you know what I mean? And then she didn't agree with what was going on with the abuse. She didn't want to have to hurt people. I think my main thing was, even with the naive ones, that even though they left, why didn't you call? Why didn't you say something? Why didn't you call the police and like at least tip them off? Like, hey, I was just working for this place and this is crazy. But I think it's that fear of knowing how powerful these people are. I mean, some of these people had it's so political too. They had politicians, judges, lawyers, cops, neighbors paid off, whole towns believing that they were doing, you know, acts of good with these children and that they were just praying with the children, but really they were praying on children. And a lot of the times, a lot of people don't understand this neither about these programs. They like to play matchmaker and they would set you up and then kind of train you to take over these places. And so when you were a girl in the program that was about to age out, instead of letting you go back home, they try to keep you there as staff and then marry one of the boys and then make them as staff and just kind of continue that sick legacy. It's crazy. Herman Fountain Sr.'s eldest son, Bubba, his wife was a Bethel girl. She was in Bethel or in the Bethel program back when it was Bethel Children's Home when she was 16. And she was, I say, conned into marrying Herman and then having kids with him and then that cycle of abuse. And then by the time she was like, okay, I'm done, the damage is done, you know?
Yeah. More time lost. You mentioned, and this is another layer of all of this that's so fascinating. It's like you mentioned the relationship with law enforcement and, you know, I think of Agape and the loopholes that threw into everything there. But this is very common in a lot of these smaller towns, like, oh, the sheriff's department works with us a lot. Like there's so many pieces where seemingly the government is not only helping or allowing these things to happen, they're actively helping these groups to continue. I guess like, and again, I think it's because we're human beings and we try to like make sense of things that just are horrific.
Right.
Like I find myself so often, like I'm steeped in these stories, whether it's church abuse or these programs, where you start going down these rabbit trails, like with Lester Roloff, and you're like, this feels tinfoil hat conspiracy.
Right. I feel like, I feel like that, you know, that meme on Facebook, the crazy conspiracy. Yes. Yeah.
Like I feel like that all the time. And there are things like, there is a thin line there, right? Of like what we know and what it seems like is going on. Like, I guess in researching this and talking about this, because like you haven't said anything to me that I haven't heard in some way said. And I say that to mean you're not just spouting crazy thing. Like these are real provable things. Like someone listening for the first time is going, what in the world? And I'm going like, yeah, I know. And even knowing it, it sounds crazy.
I know. Like,
how do you temper like not going down the rabbit hole to where it's like, okay, I'm losing credibility or I'm going into something that's not, you know, because I feel like people look for reasons to discard these stories.
Yeah. And you don't want to get lost in the sauce. So I actually learned from experience. Until you are telling it and you kind of learn to pick up on people and notice what the tone. It's really the tone, because at first when I was telling my story, I was so angry. It was almost like remembering all these fresh things in my mind. And so I seemed so angry. And now I'm calm when I talk, you know, I'm smiling. Some parts of my story, I will cry, but for the most part, I prefer to tell it like a stand-up comedy routine, but I want people to know that I'm being serious and not joking or adding something in there to make it seem funny, because it's bad enough. You don't need to add anything to it, you know? So I think the main things, I mean, the history in itself is crazy. So staying on the main topics of what's going on today and using my story as a reference of, hey, I lived this. This is my experience. This is what happened to me. But mainly keeping focus on what's going on today with kids and like Taylor Goodridge, Cornelius Fredericks, JC Onteri, Monique Payne, Erin Gower, all these children that have died in the programs, and keeping the main focus on them, because I know I'll probably never get justice for what happened to me. All my abusers are slowly dying off and I'm fine with that as long as they can't hurt nobody else. But the thing is, they've trained people who have trained people who have trained people. So there's always this fear in my head of, oh my God, what if they reopen? Or what if they try to restart and rebrand? Because that's a thing that they do all the time is rebrand, relocate, because there is no federal legislation stopping these places.
Yeah. I want to get into that, that piece of it, but I asked that just because for myself, I know there's times like, it's such a delicate dance sometimes of like, especially with people, I think like the way that I look at it, and I'm just talking to you at this point. Like, hopefully people listening.
Can I track, like that. But,
Yeah, I do too. The way that I see it now in terms of these things, like, you're not going to change the leadership. Like, and I think people look at what I do sometimes, like sitting down with a leader publicly or sending an open letter to get a response. Mm-hmm. Like, I would be, I don't even know how I would respond if I actually got any real response from any of those things. But like, for me, it's like, they're not going to change. The goal of reaching out in those moments is to prove they're not going to respond. Like, I want the paper trail. Like, they right. do not care. It is undeniable.
We gave you the opportunity to debunk what we're saying and call us liars. If there's anything you want to say, say it. But most of the time they don't. I mean, I gave Jack Patterson. Yeah, statement. I gave no. Jack Patterson made a post on Facebook and tagged me in it saying, oh, these are some of the girls who tried to help. And I was like, oh, name one way you tried to help me. And then I named nothing but facts, not theories. The thing is by naming all the facts, name the facts of what happened. This happened. You don't have to go into the certain details of, yeah, they made me pick cotton. Are people going to believe that I picked cotton? No, it's going to sound crazy. I know I went through it. The kids who went through it with me know we went through it. But instead of saying, oh, they made me pick cotton, they use prisoner of war tactics to get me to submit. You know, so that's kind of like kind of like a learning process, because I didn't have anyone teaching me, holding me by the hand, teaching me how to be an advocate and to share my story. I just was sharing it. I got bored during COVID. TikTok was a thing and I needed an outlet and I just went for it. And now I have almost 18,000 followers. That's still not a lot, but I would rather have people who are actively listening and caring about what I went through and caring about what these kids are going through than a huge following. My story saves one parent from putting their kid in a program, making a wrong mistake and forever fucking them up for life, then it's worth it. Yeah. If my story changes somebody's opinion on donating to one of these programs that come and talk a good game in their church, then it's worth it to me.
Yeah. Yeah. There's if no someone advocacy would have viewed, 101.
Yeah. If someone would have viewed my life as worth it, you know, back then, I know I'm not saying that my life is horrible now or that I'm not. I, of course, have imposter syndrome, so I don't feel like I'm successful. I feel like I'm so much further behind in life than everybody else, and I don't have it together. But then when I listen to other people, I'm like, I actually have it together. Like, you know what I mean? And so then I'm like, okay, my main thing is not even just the awareness part. I see so much suffering within the community of survivors. There's so many people who are left broken. They don't know how to do things still. And so I'm like, well, let me give you my knowledge, because I'm not going to gatekeep what helped me. You know, you don't know how to apply for a home loan. I bought a home. Let me show you how I did it. You know, social skills, your kid's missing those. Let me tell you what I did. You know what I mean? Because we need that. And I just want to help and support people. I know Tana told you this, but I'm a direct support professional. So I've been taking care of people with developmental disabilities for about 15 years. And that's what I do for a living. And so through that, I also learned how to be an advocate for them. When I was researching the history of what was going on with institutions back then for people with disabilities, it's the same thing that's going on with the kids today. It's the same things that's going on with the kids when they were taken from their homes and put into these Native American boarding schools. It's the same shit, different toilet.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the point I was wanting to make, is like, I think people get focused, and it's kind of the frustrating thing about it, like you mentioned, like the social side or like growing the platform. It's such a double-edged sword, because the thing that grows platforms, and we've seen it with plenty of times over, like the things that grow the platform are not necessarily the things that make real change. And I think getting really pissed and screaming at people will grow your platform. And I think there's a time and a place for that. Like, right. I think we both agree there's times to go to the mats about stuff.
Yeah.
But then, or it's taking stances that are like so in the middle, like where it's easily agreeable, but it doesn't really push for anything that matters. And I really love the approach of trying, like when I create content, I try to think about the person who's got one cheek in the pew, basically. They're thinking about, there's some things that are wrong, but I can justify it. And I think when, like you said, when you can lay out the facts in a very clear way, like those are the people that are going to shift. The leadership's not going to, the right. Hardcore followers aren't typically going to. It's the people that see it, but don't know how to process it and don't know that there's anything.
And don't know how to speak up and say anything. I mean, there's so many times that us kids in the programs had to sit there and watch another child get dragged across the floor by their hair or get beat in front of us, and you couldn't react. You couldn't help in or jump in and help or do anything, because you were like, oh, are they going to beat me? Are they going to do the same thing? And now as an adult, I'm so triggered. If a parent literally yells at a kid, I'm ready to, it's like that movie, Jolt, where she's got that like issue where she wants to like snatch somebody up for hurting people. It's like that. When I see bad people do bad things, I want to do bad things to them sometimes. I want to snatch them up, but I can't do that because I'll go to jail in prison. So you got to find a way to do it. What do you do in that instant? Do you just walk on by, or are you going to say something? So the thing is you got to learn how to be able to approach people and talk to people without like wanting to get into a fight, or, you know what I mean? There's ways that you can do it. And there's ways that, hey, you know, if you see a kid in Walmart and, you know, their mom's dragging them up by their arm and you're like, hey, that hurts the kid. A lot of times parents don't know, because that's what was done to them. Hey, that actually can dislocate your child's shoulder. Did you know? Instead of being hostile, like, eh, you know what I mean? Because some things that are abusive, and I'm not saying it's an excuse, parents are doing it because it was done to them and they don't know any better. We need to start giving parents tools to know better. This is wrong. Even though your parents did it to you, it's not okay. Your kid doesn't deserve it. This is what you do instead. This is what should have been done for you. This is what you need to do. And we need to start having more community-based programs and outreach services that help parents be able to stay, or kids stay with these families and give these families the tools, and then stop giving the parents that are not going to change the opportunity to re-hurt the child over and over again. Cause we see that on the news. I'm tired of it, you know? Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's giving, and that's what I mean, is like, that's not sexy work. You know, like, I think that's the piece. It's frustrating to me because like, I am a content creator too. And so like, there's that element where you're like, I put this together, you know, and legitimately, like if you go to my YouTube and you go like most popular to least, I think you can sort the other way. But if you do most popular to least and you scroll all the way to the bottom, some of my favorite interviews and the most helpful interviews are like, oh, 500 views. Cause like people aren't interested in those practical steps that are right. Actually going to help. But there's so much more valuable than just, like I said before we hit record, like there's so much more helpful than the stuff that gets, like, the trauma tourism, like, tell me all the gritty details, the true crime mentality approach to this stuff. It's like, yeah, that's really bad and we should talk about it and there's an appropriate way to talk about it. But now what do we do? And I think that's what I have loved from this conversation so far and from everything you've said before we hit record is like, let's talk about the past. It matters, but let's talk about the things that are happening right now. Like right now, there are kids going through the experiences that you went through at varying degrees all over the country in Baptist programs, Mormon programs, totally secular programs that have copied, you know, all of these, you know, the synonyms of the world. Like there's some really horrific things happening.
Systematic issue. Yeah. This affects white kids, brown kids, poor kids, rich kids. I mean, if you're a kid and they can make money off of you, they're going to do it.
Right.
Money don't grow on trees. It grows off the backs of troubled teens and corporate greed.
Hmm. No, I just thinking about the label, like troubled teen, it's such an uphill battle, like even addressing the industry. Cause like when you say it, you're starting them at a disadvantage in the conversation. It's like, it's
automatically placing blame on the child.
Well, they were troubled. Mm-hmm. So,
and then, you know, my friend Hannah Kay, who has troubled parent industry on her stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if I can get with that neither. Cause some parents are literally trying to do what they thought was best. A lot of parents with not as many resources and low income communities, this is what they're given as an option for help. You know what I mean? So I think about what I went through and then what I needed. So my son has two tutors that he meets with 4 days a week, 1 to 2 hours a day. That is a resource that most Americans will never be able to access. If it wasn't for having friends in high places, I wouldn't have had access to it. You know what I mean? So I'm tired of the gatekeeping. We need to have more access to that. I want to be able to create a network of teachers who want to volunteer or students who are going to school for teaching, volunteer to help these kids. You know, there's something that needs to be done. If you're abusing children in these places, in these programs, let's rip these funding away from you. You don't get to operate. You're going to go on a registry. You're never going to be able to work with kids. That funding is now going to be put into a community-based place that's going to actually help the community. I think if we got back to what community actually looks like, what communities need, we could eradicate all this. We could be saving taxpayers millions of dollars if they would just listen. I have great ideas.
Yeah. This all sounds great. I'm curious, like, I think the biggest issue with a lot of these conversations is like, there's like the problem that feels vast and it is complicated. And it is like, we could spend hours and hours and hours talking about one version of these programs. You mentioned before we record, like there is people's tax dollars are literally going to these places that they don't know that it is, you know, and the same goes for Christian schools that are not even troubled teen homes, like literal just Christian schools that are teaching really crazy stuff to kids. You talk about, you know, the shocking amount of deaths, which like, that's something to me that, again, I can't wrap my head around that programs are still open that have had countless deaths in the last couple of years. And I see people like Amanda Householder sharing those stories. And I go like, well, that would clearly shut them down. But no, they keep getting funding and they keep having kids sent. What is something, if someone's listening to this and rightfully so feels pissed off about this and they're going, I don't know where step one is to even addressing this, like what are some things that people should be considering doing if this is an issue that's important to them? And it should be important to everybody on some level.
You need to get a hold of your state legislators, people. You need to get a hold of your state legislators, start getting involved. You vote these people in that are making these decisions on where your tax dollars go, how these programs, whether they are allowed to operate with oversight, which there is none right now. That's one of Roloff's big things in the programs was no oversight. They want to shut us down and they want to control what we're we're teaching and da, da, da. I believe that you should have the freedom to choose whatever religion you want to be. But the moment that that religion is used as a tool and a weapon to hurt and abuse children, the state should be involved. If you're forcing children, especially, I saw kids of all walks of life who weren't even religious being forced to believe and conform to this religion. If we're not allowed to do this in public schools, why are they allowed to do this in private organizations? That's not okay. We need to get a hold of our legislators, let them know that these places exist. You can go to unsilence.org and see if there's a program that's operating in your town, and send them an email and start telling them, hey, why do we not? It's 2024. Kids don't have a Bill of Rights in America. It took people with developmental disabilities decades, not until like, I think 1976, before they even got a Bill of Rights. The things that we're doing in the state of Ohio to downsize ICFMR huge, big facilities and get these people into community-based waiver settings where they live in their own homes. We come and provide their services. It's the same thing that we need to be doing with these children. Stop putting them in huge facilities, keep them in the community. Let's get a county board that actually comes in and checks on these people, because CPS isn't doing their job, so it needs to go to somebody else. We need to have UIs and MUIs where a kid gets hurt, you got to fill out a report and send it to the county board. You don't report it, guess what? You're going to get investigated. There's all kinds of, it's an easy fix. They just need to do it, and they need to listen, and they need to get the data on how many of these programs exist, what kinds of kids go to these places. There needs to be a criteria before you're even allowed to be sent away that must be met. And this needs to be viewed as a mental health issue. It's no. mental health. I mean, if you hurt your finger, you break your finger, are you going to pray to God that your finger stops hurting? Are you going to go to the hospital and get an x-ray to see if it's broken or not? You're going to go to the hospital. It's the same thing with your brain and with your heart. I believe that faith is great. Everybody needs a little bit of faith to hold on to, but it takes more than just faith. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I got cancer, I'm not going to pray the cancer away. I'm going to get chemo. I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to look up every holistic. I wouldn't do chemo, but a lot of people would. You know, I'm going to do whatever radiation, right. whatever it is, to make sure that I live a long time and I beat this cancer. It's the same thing with mental health.
Yeah. You need a practical tools.
Health, yeah. Yes. A mental health professional. And then in some cases, these hospitals and places that are saying that they're helping children, they're just as guilty too. There needs to be a higher level standard of care and a criteria that this is the bar. If you don't reach this bar, you're not going to work with children. You're not, yeah. And that's just how it needs to be.
Right. And it sounds like from what you're saying, I'm one of the hot debates. There's many, as an outsider looking in, there's many hot debates within the troubled teen advocacy space. And I know it's something I talk to Hannah about pretty frequently, is like, help me understand this between all of these different groups that are trying to do different things. It seems like there's some in the advocacy space that are like abolition or nothing, like we need to shut it all down. And
I'm not an abolitionist.
It seems like there's others that are like, we can take this incremental approach to, because, and obviously on paper, if you could shut down all of them tomorrow,
oh yeah,
that would be incredible. We'll all sign that, you know?
I would love to shut it all down and rebuild from scratch, honestly. And right. Hey, this is the bar, this is what we're going to do. But where are these kids going to go? I think really, if we abolish this, you're forgetting about the one third of the population of foster kids and adoptees that when there's no foster homes, guess where we get dumped off at? Where are we going to go? We're going to be homeless. These kids need somewhere to go. Instead of lumping us all in together, let's create more places for kids in foster care situations instead of lumping them in as troubled. That's what happened to Frederick Cornelius. And then he wound up dying over throwing a sandwich. It still pisses me off.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's making those little incremental changes to the system. And that's the realistic approach, yeah, too, is you're going against multi-billion dollar industry. How can we raise the bar?
That's why I like to use the history of what happened to people with developmental disabilities and what we're doing in the state of Ohio. So if you were to go to Board of Developmental Disabilities, you'll see that we actually have what's called a county board. And when you are disabled and you live in an IO waiver, which is paid through Medicaid funding, you live in a regular house in the community with 2-3 other roommates. You have a person like me who comes in and makes your day better. We cook your meals, we pass your meds, help you with your daily living skills. And we have what's called an individual specific plan, an ISP. And it tells me everything I need to know about this person, their trauma, what makes them tick, what they like, what they don't like, what they need, what their goals are. And this is what we need to be doing for children. These children have needs and goals. Okay. So for me, my goal would have been like, Sabrina has dyslexia and has suffered tremendous trauma throughout her years from her abusive family. Sabrina does not like it when you raise her voice. Sabrina does best as a visual learner. And it kind of just breaks it down. And the plan for helping these children should be broken down on how to, someone should be able to read that, be trained on that, and know how to, as a professional, be able to work with that child. But because people are not getting this training, it's this one size fits all. Here, you're going to follow this program and you're going to read the Bible 4 times a day. Like, the Bible didn't teach me to be able to resolve conflict. It didn't teach me my multiplication tables. It didn't teach me how to speak up for myself when somebody's hurting me. You know, these things, these goals. And I think if we were to start implementing this and looking at what this child needs, because each child is different based on why they were sent away, and do it that way. I do believe that there needs to be a higher standard of care. We have a level of training that even I have to go through. And we have training that we do monthly to keep up in services. And there is no training with these people. It's like their training comes from Jesus. They had the famous saying that God doesn't qualify the called. God doesn't qualify the call, or doesn't
call the qualified.
He qualifies the called, you know, and so we need people who are qualified. I don't know about you, but I could say all day long that I'm a brain surgeon. God qualified me to be a brain surgeon. So yeah. I can perform brain surgery on you. Are you going to let me perform brain surgery on you without seeing my qualifications and how many people's lives I've saved? No. Talk is cheap.
Yeah. Right.
Show me the evidence. We need evidence-based things and what they're doing. It's not evidence-based.
Right.
You can use faith is just a little portion. It should not be the fixed solution.
No.
You have faith all day long. I can tell you all day long that the sky is purple. It's purple. I have faith that the sky is purple. And you can look at it and be like, no, bitch, it's blue. And I'm like, nope, it's purple. That's not going to change anything.
Right.
You know, it's going to make me sound delusional.
No. So, well, and it's got a place, you know, and
yeah.
Yeah. And I think having a plan in general is a good step. Like you said, like the one size fits all fit into my box isn't going to be applicable the same way it wouldn't medically in any of these cases.
A child that they can't speak we were on dorm silence for like months, years, you know, at
which time. Is so developmentally harmful.
So like, harmful. Provably, I mean, so. As you can tell, I'm a chatterbox. So you can imagine what I was like.
As you can tell, so am I.
So you can just imagine. Yeah. I could not shut up. I was the weird kid that would read an encyclopedia and be like, hey, did you know that if you drank a glass of water before you ate, it helps your digestive tract? Like, I was that kid. So yes, I was annoying. I read books all the time. I'd want to tell you about these books. I had a wild imagination. And so I would tell you about all these things that I found in these books. I mean, when the book Holes came out, I was like, oh my gosh, it's like reading about my life, you know? And and so they're like, you're reading this book too much. You need to read more of the Bible. But I had enough of the Bible. I wanted to read some Sylvia Plath, some other stuff going on in the world. And they made everything seem like if it wasn't XYZ, it was worldly. You were going to go to hell. Right. And it just, and when I got out the program, I was like, this is not how the world works. Like, I understand what they're talking about when they say Hollywood is evil. Do I think all of Hollywood is evil? No. Majority of it probably is. But you can take something that is good or not necessarily bad, and it can be evil. Just like these programs that were portrayed as good, but guess what? They were evil.
Right, right. I mean, I've legitimately really enjoyed this conversation, and I could talk for a lot longer, and I hope it's not the last time that we talk. I sincerely I would love to pick this up for further discussion. It's been really helpful. And again, I love all the different perspectives on all of this. Like, I've probably done 10 to 15 conversations about kind of the troubled teen space. And I love getting all the different ways that it's impacted, the context going in, the approaches to advocacy. And like, I've really loved just the emphasis on having legitimate plans for the kids in these programs. Like, it's the I don't know if you've, I know you say you listen to some past episodes and things, like one of the conversations that really changed the way I looked at just American Christianity as a machine was in Kristen Dumais's book, where she talks about in like the first or second chapter of her book, she talks about the idea that early American Christianity was, she called it cowboy Christianity. And she said the whole concept was basically reining in chaos, like creating order out of chaos. And I see so much in the troubled teen industry, this idea of it's not about transformation or change. It's about like conforming to our way of what we think it should be. It's the kid should be seen, not heard, like approach. And I think, you know, I've heard that critique about law enforcement, which is a whole nother conversation, but like, maybe a future
conversation. I feel like we're going to have lots of conversations later on.
But it's that concept of like, you know, I forget the book I was reading, but it was basically talking about like the push for preserving law and order and what that means versus protecting and serving. Like, there's a whole dialogue that's not happening when it's all about creating order and not serving the individual and allowing that individual to be themselves and contribute to society as themselves. But again, that's a conversation for another day, sadly.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much. What's the best way for people to connect with you? And I know you mentioned TikTok.
What's the handle? My name handle is the Hot Girl Advocate on TikTok.
I should have done something as the Hot Boy Advocate for mine. Oh, well.
Well, what happened was I actually went to DC. 1111 Media, Paris Hilton's team, had the Senate Finance Committee. And I was like, I want to know what's going on. Mm. And this investigational 2-year investigation that they've been doing on the warehouses of these programs, I want to know. So I wound up going and getting involved. And a few girls were doing like a TikTok for Paris Hilton, doing the whole sa 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 sa, you know, dance. And I was like, oh, let me pop in there and do it too. And I did. And she had posted it on her Facebook. And my daughter was like, oh my God, Paris Hilton posted my mom. And so she had reposted it and goes, when Paris Hilton post your mommy and her friends doing hot girl advocacy shit. And I was like, that's the name. That's
save that the TikTok. Right now.
Yep. So yep. Hot girl advocate. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, go connect over on TikTok, Sabrina. Definitely. Let's get something on the calendar again. I'd love to chat a little bit more. This is great.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.